Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is the 17th of January, and I am continuing what I suppose is becoming a series of podcasts with David L'Esperance, who is a mobility consultant, meaning that he helps people achieve second citizenships or second residences in other countries. For a variety of reasons. As you know, there are plenty of people who want to minimize their ties in certain parts of the world right now. For example, I would not want to be in Hong Kong, I don't think. That extends to there are people, I think David would probably acknowledge that he's getting more and more calls from Americans who are at least beginning to realize the importance of second citizenships and residence as insurance policies. And there was an interesting article about that and in one of the publications today. But when we talk about second citizenships, residence, we're talking really about immigration concepts. And of course, we never do anything without considering tax. And one of the most important things to consider in terms of tax are, of course, the tax treaties between various countries. So David is joining me today, and that is our basic topic, tax treaties and how they impact choice of citizenship and residence. So welcome, David. Welcome back. It's great to speak with you again.
Thank you, John. Great to be back again.
So treaties are not the most interesting things to read. Would you agree?
I would agree that they are an often overlooked tool, but an excellent tool in our toolbox when we look how resident citizenship and domicile impact the total global tax burden that an individual or family would have.
Well, there's no doubt about that. And of course, treaties impact this in a lot of different ways. I mean, some of it's the tax burden, but there are also issues with respect to information exchange. And of course, assistance and collections. So this is something that I personally think is a huge issue for people who consider these types of things. And you know, you're more up on this than I am, but would it be fair to say that the big treaty issue countries are going to be the first world democracies, European countries, and less so with respect to the Caribbean citizenships? Would that be correct?
Yes. Traditionally, the kind of G20 countries where there was a lot of trade, because treaties deal not only with individual, but with corporate taxation, have entered into agreements for really the last 70 or 80 years. A few small countries, Barbados being a shining example of that, actually entered into a number of treaties because they saw that as a very effective tool in order to develop their, you know, role as an international financial center. And then there were smaller countries which traditionally were relying on secrecy planning, which is, I think you would agree, John, foolish planning in these days of whistleblowers and exchange of information and common reporting standards.
All you're betting on is time.
It's not a question anymore of if, it's when.
Yeah.
And so jurisdictions are starting, more and more jurisdictions are starting to enter into what may not be a full double taxation treaties, but exchange of information treaties, as you refer to.
Okay, of which the most recent and probably the most visible would be the common reporting standard, right?
Correct.
Now, as sort of a segue into our conversation, the Reader's Digest description of the Common Reporting Standard, and I mean very Reader's Digest, 30, 50,000 view description of it would be that countries are basically reporting on financial accounts held by people who have tax residency in other countries, right? So for example, if a tax resident of France, had a brokerage account in Canada, presumably that would be reported to the government of France. Is that a fair description?
Correct. So there is now a push to who is the ultimate beneficial owner of an account in that country. And then once you've identified that ultimate beneficial owner, are they tax resident in another country? If so, let's tell them about the account we have for them here.
Right. Now, we could, though, have a situation where we have, let's keep, you know, keeping on the level of the individual, where we had somebody who was, for some reason, a tax resident of France, who had a brokerage account in Canada. Now, let's hypothesize for a moment that that individual is also a tax resident of Canada. So we have dual tax residency. Tax resident of France, tax resident of Canada, for whatever reason. How could the treaty be used to make sure that that individual was treated as a tax resident of only one country for the purposes of the common reporting standard?
So tax treaties or conventions in the context of individuals were agreements that were entered into to avoid double taxation, because that was seen as unfair and not very good for business. If you've got two countries who are looking to tax, in this case, France and Canada, that individual, the tax treaty is, as I like to describe it, kind of the Queensberry rules as to who is going to get the actual tax payment and who is simply going to get a notation on their return of a foreign tax credit. And it's really, the agreement is so that the person is not paying, in this case, both to France and to Canada. And the treaty really is going to define which country is going to get the money and which country is going to hear about the fact that tax was paid on it in another country.
Or to put it another way, the treaty can be used to assign that individual who is a tax resident according to the domestic laws of each country, to assign that individual's tax residence to one country or the other, correct?
Correct.
And these are, and I think we've discussed this before, these are, you know, in the profession, in the media, in the world, referred to as tiebreaker rules.
Correct. And an important point is, these are the Queensberry rules when these two countries are fighting over the same thing. So if you have a jurisdiction such as the UK, which has an estate tax, and a country like Canada, which doesn't have an estate tax, then they're not fighting over it. The UK wins, gets it all. So it's one of the things also to look at. And when you're looking at different countries, do they have gift tax, estate tax, and much more relevant in current environment is, do they or will they have wealth taxes?
Well, that is clearly coming. That is clearly coming. But okay, so we have various different kinds of taxes in the world. We have different kinds of treaties. Let's say for a moment, we'll come back to the estate gift tax treaties in a minute, but let's work with just an individual tax treaty. So this is pretty standard stuff, and the standard tax treaty tiebreaker would look to what factors in our example with this person as a tax resident of both countries, what factors would be used under the treaty to determine which country he was assigned tax residency to?
So most treaties today, whether they were entered into for the first time or revised, really come up to an OECD standard. And they have a number of different tiebreaker rules. So the first thing that they look at is, does the individual have a permanent home available to them? So in our case of our France, Canada, does the person have a permanent home available to them in Canada, but not in France? Canada wins.
So that would terminate right there without having to go further down the list, right?
Correct. So there are a series of, if this question is answered positive for one country and negative for the other, that's the determination. If they have a permanent home available to them in both jurisdictions, you then go down to the next one, which is the center of vital interest. If they have center of vital interest, but where's the play? There's a series, a cascading series But as soon as you answer the question definitively, one way or another, that determines who wins the fight for the money.
Okay. So just keep track of where we're going here, where we've been. So we start with these tax treaties that apply in many circumstances, but certainly include definitions of tax residency for each country, right? Or apply in certain circumstances when somebody is a tax resident of each country. And the tax treaty tiebreaker is used specifically when it's determined that somebody is a tax residency of both countries, and to allow that person to assign his tax residency to only one country or the other. And once that tax residency is assigned to, say, Canada, it means that that individual is treated as a Canadian tax resident. Canada taxes the worldwide income and not France, correct?
Correct. I will give one aside from, there is some exceptions for certain CITES income. So if you have, for example, in our case, Canada wins, but they have some French CITES income, France may get first kick at that. Canada is going to tax worldwide everything else.
Right. So there are other treaty provisions that would, for example, say that income from real estate,
correct,
would be taxable. France would have the first right of taxation. So subject to all those other rules. But with respect to the jurisdiction over the individual himself, that's how the tax treaty works. It would assign it to one over another. Now, that is a very, very helpful thing to individuals. You know, they get these tax residency, these CRS letters in Canada saying, you know, what country are you a tax resident of? So I think our first point is that tax treaties are relevant in assigning residents and in people's ability to answer the question, well, I'm a tax resident in our case of Canada and not France.
Correct.
But there is one group of people in the world that has been carved out for special treatment with respect to these tax treaty tiebreakers. And I see you smiling there, and that's because you're from Windsor, Ontario, I guess. So you know all about these Americans to whom much has been given, much is expected, I guess. Americans, can they use a tax treaty tiebreaker?
So normally, who is a taxpayer is defined by some physical day count and or some connections test. So sojourning or a connections test. And they vary in some jurisdictions, but generally speaking, it's 6 months of physical presence or less than 6 months, but you've got certain ties. The U.S., and I'm loath to actually include from a practical sense Eritrea on this, but you know, the U.S. is the major country and they own it. They also have, being a U.S. person, that you are a U.S. citizen, even if you've never stepped foot in the United States, or you acquired that citizenship through a parent, for example, or you're like Boris Johnson, you were born in the United States when your parents were seconded there for education or work, and moved out of the jurisdiction when you were a child. And so that citizenship-based taxation kind of plays havoc with the normal Queensbury rules, because the Americans, you know, they apply the status of U.S. taxpayer, U.S. person for tax purposes, in a much wider swath than every other country.
So to put it simply, there is no way for a U.S. citizen to use a treaty tiebreaker to assign tax residency to another country and not to the United States, right?
U.S. citizen, U.S. person for tax purposes, you have three times that occurs. One is a citizen, one is a resident alien / green card holder, and somebody who spends too much time physically in the country under something called the substantial presence test. The tiebreaker rules may come in handy for the latter two, for the green card holder and or for the substantial presence, but it's not going to help them so long as they have that citizenship.
Which is, I suppose, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, there's been an increase in the number of Americans wishing to get rid of citizenship. But be that as it may. Okay. So these treaties in a global world obviously matter hugely. So we use the treaties to assign tax residence. Let's talk a little bit about provisions of the treaty, though, that make a difference to the average person, generally and perhaps in terms of any specific countries. So a treaty will, for example, have rules for, you know, who taxes pension income, or how dividends are taxed, or how income from real property is taxed, etc. What are your thoughts or comments on that?
Well, I'm going to throw one technical term to you. Whenever I'm talking about clients' assets, I say they have a bunch of stuff. They have everything from pensions to real property to active business to passive income. And just looking at the concept of pensions, many governments around the world have concluded that it's a good policy to allow their citizens to save for their retirement. But the vehicles in which they design that are designed under domestic law. So for example, RSPs in Canada versus ISAs in the UK, they're not exactly the same versus 401ks, for example, in the United States. So when you're looking for what people universally call pensions or retirement funds, you really have to dig down and understand how the varying jurisdictions look at that vehicle.
And so, David, I mean, it's conceivable, I suppose, that something might be considered a pension in one country and not in another.
Correct. So where there's complexity, there's also opportunity. So this is where, especially if you know, it makes sense from a financial point of view, getting expert advice and choosing jurisdictions on which you are going to fall into your preferred jurisdiction to have a preferred result. And that may be to deal with one particular piece of your stuff, such as a pension plan, or it may be an overall, so that your total global tax burden is reduced, because you can use a tax treaty as a shield against other jurisdictions and say, no, thank you very much, I'm tax resident in country B, sorry, country A. And if country A says, well, you pay less tax, I said, that may be absolutely true. If you have a problem with that, please take that up with the legislature of this country I've chosen to come to. So it does provide a lot of arbitrage opportunities.
Right. So to be clear, the message that I hope that listeners would be getting from this is that if you are considering getting a second citizenship, which may or may not involve residence, or in fact moving to another country and becoming tax resident of that country, and if you have a wide range of assets, including pensions from the first country, you really need to get some pretty solid advice on what your tax situation is going to look like in relation to those assets, right?
And in seeking that type of advice or doing any type of structure, I always tell clients to consider something I've come to call the rule of three. They should see at least three times in tax savings the cost of any advice or setting up a particular structure. So for example, If the tax damage on your pension is a couple of $100,000 in tax, it's well worth it to spend a few thousand dollars to get some expert advice on a tax treaty.
Yeah.
But for example, we used to in Canada, bringing people into Canada, in something called Section 94 Immigrant Trust, which is pretty straightforward. Basically, it's a trust that was set up, or you set it up. Should you do that? And by the time you paid the lawyers and the trustees and the underlying corporation, let's say that you spent, say, $15,000 US on that total structure, you should see at least $45,000 in tax savings. Now, that advice from somebody like you or another tax lawyer or tax lawyer in the jurisdictions, it's going to be the same price whether you've got 100,000 or 100 million. But obviously the tax benefit is going to be greater. So once you've hit the point of where it makes sense from the rule of three, the question moves from should I do this to why aren't I doing this?
Yeah. You know, particularly in the area of pensions, this is an observation. I've seen so many people, I wouldn't call them a modest means. Okay. But, you know, been damaged by moving to places where they didn't know how their pensions were going to be taxed. Okay. Now, so we need to look at the total tax situation. And one of the most interesting things about our last discussion about moving to Canada was you made the point that Canada does not, for example, have a formal gift or estate tax, but other countries do. So you would agree that this is something that also needs to be considered?
Oh, absolutely. I can't remember if we talked about it in our prior conversations, but when Harry and Meghan decided that they were going to leave the UK and they first came to Canada, I thought, oh, wonderful choice. Canada doesn't have an estate tax, so Harry doesn't have to worry about that. Meghan is unfortunately a US person for tax purposes, and the US has a state tax. But Harry could very well, the estate tax is not paid, well, we assume Charles passes first, by Harry as the beneficiary or the heir, it's paid by the estate, in this case, Charles. But then when Harry moved on and was leaving money to Archie, if he doesn't have if he's not domiciled in the UK, but domiciled, for example, in Canada, which has no estate tax, Archie would get everything net free of any estate tax. And there were some other gift tax and some other complications, were involved. It was actually quite, not that I wanted to be retained by them, but they were actually a very interesting case study, especially in these blended families that we have of Americans marrying non-Americans and bringing their tax complications. But again, where there's complications, there's opportunities. It was an interesting kind of Harvard case study to go through their tax planning, but they decided to blow it all by moving to California.
I would say anyway. They blew it all is right. But, you know, I think that, you know, down the road, we'll be having a more topical discussion about that issue. But in any case, so we've got tax treaties assigning tax residents that govern how certain types of things are taxed. We have estate and gift tax treaties, and there are far fewer of those, I guess, because, well, there are far fewer countries that have estate and gift tax. But it seems to me that another thing that needs to be considered here is that, you know, treaties have many purposes, but they have exchange of information provisions, and in some cases, they have mutual assistance provisions. To what extent should people be concerned of, or at least aware of, the exchange of information provisions?
I tell clients to assume that any tax authority that's interested in you either has or can easily get the information. Came to light that there was a bunch of Belgians who were high net worth Belgians that were claiming they lived in Monaco. And they had, I mean, they were being silly. It was 1970s, claiming basically they all shared a small apartment. They were never there. Well, in a world where your mobile phone every few seconds is telling the world where you are, where every time you pull out a credit card for lunch, gasoline, or a purchase, you're telling the world where you are. That was pretty silly. And so, again, if you start with the assumption that the taxing authorities are going to know everything that they need to know, then you want to make sure that your structure is properly set up. Because if it's not, they've got the mutual collection clauses, which will help them. So the information helps them find you and find out about you. The collection clause helps you pay the tax. And that was really something, if you look at citizenship by investment, you know, the current version of it came in for the to pay for the First World War. There was on and off around the Civil War, but that's the current version of that. And again, having grown up in a border town, people always had the tax liability. That hasn't changed. Citizenship-based taxation is not new. What did change is the ability to find you and the ability to collect the tax.
Right, right. And on that note, actually maybe a couple comments on the assistance in collection. So generally speaking, the world is operated under the revenue rule, which basically says that at a minimum, it's pretty hard to get one country to help assisting another country collect its tax debts. But over the last 15, 20 years, it seems to me that there is a movement to break down the revenue rule and to put actual collection assistance mechanisms into these tax treaties. Is that your sense of this?
Correct. So that common principle has been overcome by lots of common principles are either overcome by legislation or by agreement. And in this case, it's tax treaty agreement. And so those mutual collection clauses specifically are designed to overcome the revenue rule.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, and what's quite interesting, if we look at this, I mean, Canada, of course, being a leader in this type of things with the United States, the Canada-US tax treaty has essentially overridden the revenue rule. There will be mutual assistance unless the person, the taxpayer, was a citizen of, say, Canada, if the United States is trying to collect at the time the tax debt arose, or vice versa, that if Canada is trying to collect that the person was a U.S. citizen at the time the tax collection arose. And the U.S. has got five or six of these treaties. But I would expect that as these treaties are renegotiated, you are going to see a gradual erosion and eventually outright disappearance of the revenue rule. Would you agree?
I would agree. I mean, there's a number of pieces of legislation litigation in Canada and in Europe that deals with disclosure of information rules. But the collection rules are going to be between countries are going to be really defined by, you know, what the future versions of these tax treaties will be. And the Americans use kind of the Canada-US tax treaty as the thin edge of the wedge, which they've now started to expand and which they demand in all the newest versions of their tax treaties that they're constantly renegotiating with all kinds of countries.
Right. God, I hate to end our discussion today on that note. But this has been great. I'm speaking with David Lesperance. You can find him at lesperanceassociates.com, who is a well-known global mobility consultant. And anytime somebody is interested in global mobility, they've got to concern themselves with tax and tax treaties. Any concluding words of advice or wisdom for our listeners, David?
Well, since the area wasn't complicated enough, we now, of course, have the impact of COVID, where you have people who are involuntarily spending more time in a jurisdiction than they ever intended to and have little to no choice. It will be interesting to see the challenges to claims, governments claiming, you've been here too long, you're one of ours. And the use of tax treaties to determine, that Airbnb that you originally rented for a month that you've now had for 14 months, is that a permanent abode available to you? There's going to be no lack of work for people practicing in this area.
Well, you know, I once wrote a blog post was so lengthy, I'll call it an essay. And the title of the post was, in the 21st century, the most interesting thing about a person is his or her tax residency. Agreed?
Agreed.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, David. And we'll pick this discussion up again down the road. Again, I'm speaking with David Lesperance, and you can find him at Lesperance Associates.
Thank you, John.